Hello and welcome to Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast brought to you by the experts at Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir and I'm delighted to welcome back to the hot seat Coutts CIO Alan Higgins. Alan, you've been away for a couple of weeks on holiday. Well, I have to say you certainly picked a good time to go away on holiday. Lots been going on. Did you have a good holiday?
Thank you very much. Yes, I did the classic combination of the Alps in the summer and Wales.
Both very nice. Did you catch any fish?
I did catch a couple of fish, a couple of sea bass, put them back to live another day. But yes, I did see the news, and probably important for listeners, it's time like this that listeners should remember that I'm pleased I'm an investment specialist.
Yeah.
I have been for 35 years, and you focus on investment comms, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So
yeah.
Anyone tuning in looking for other kinds of information, I'm sorry, but you know, we focus only on investments here.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to remind you, Alan, because you have been away for a couple of weeks, we are going to look at the three things investors need to know for the week yes. ahead. So what are the three things investors need to know?
So three things. I want to talk about some things, kind of a hangover, but three things. Well, while I was away, also Jane Birkin died.
Yes, yes.
And I've got a bit of an obsession with, an unhealthy obsession, I think, with Hermes Birkin bags.
Yeah, well, haven't we both?
Intrigued with any asset that might compete with equities.
Yes.
I'm well known as the Coutts equity bull, long run.
Mm, yeah.
By the way, what does it mean for the next year? Almost nothing. But I'm talking about the long run. And assets that compete. So we'll, I want to talk a little bit about that. And, you know, actually, what has been the better investment? A Hermes Birkin bag? Or stocks, or Hermes stock.
It's tempting. I know which one I'd probably get more enjoyment out of. But.
True. So we'll look at that. I want to look at the Fitch downgrade.
Yes.
That happened.
Yeah.
And then have a bit of a rant about something obscure, you know. But you
good,
know,
good, good.
We love a rant. And then finally, this bull market in stocks, because it is a bull market in stocks. Do you remember, Sarah, it was hard to find a bull?
It was. You know, struggled. You only came up with one.
We found one. Yeah. Now it's hard to find a bear. You know,
okay.
But I'm going to give you a bear's argument. So the bearish argument for US stocks from JP Morgan, their holding firm. I'll tell you where the others have gone. But before that, we should probably do a bit of a catch up.
I think we should do, actually. Now, I wanted to ask you, because just before you went away, we talked about Wimbledon debentures. And then there was a bit of a question mark about after we saw this incredible final. Well, you saw this incredible final. I didn't watch it. But Alcaraz, Djokovic, because I was a big Djokovic fan, so I didn't want to watch him go out. But I was curious to know how that was going to impact the valuation of debentures, because we're talking about challenges for equities. So did that have a positive or a negative impact on debentures?
So Wimbledon debentures, as a reminder, it's the only way legally you can sell a ticket. So they have real value. So if Brad Pitt wants to go to the men's final, he did. The only way he can get a ticket is to buy a debenture ticket. No doubt his friend Roger gave him one, mine, but you know, who knows. But basically, that's how it works. And they were trading at, so the men's final tickets were trading at £10,000.
Yeah.
Selling at £10,000. So debentures, so look, they have been, and I want to do the IRR, the investment rate of return on these in more depth another time when it's quiet, but they have been a phenomenally good investment that have also competed with equities.
Yeah.
But that amazing final that he missed, I can't believe it, Alcaraz triumph, what was it worth? I can tell you we have the answers. Centre Court debentures, they've only got 2 years left. They used to trade at 100,000 for 2 years each. They now trade at 108,000.
Wow.
So Carlos Alcaraz, amongst other things, amazingly, you added 8% to Centre Court debenture holders' wealth. As a reminder, sadly, I don't own Centre Court debentures. I'm a lowly Court One debenture holder. The tennis fans, the cheapo seats. So there's been it's quite interesting, right? I mean, because we talk about the danger is with the big three retiring or getting close to retirement. Would there still be the demand for Wimbledon debentures? Well, I think Carlos Alcaraz is the new superstar. And you need to watch his shots. Have you seen any of his shots?
I have. What I watched a little bit after you mentioned him when we first talked about Wimbledon debentures. And he is very impressive. But as you said, as you know, I'm not the world's biggest tennis fan. But who else then? Is it going to be Alcaraz? I appreciate we are turning into a sports podcast here. But just very quickly, I want to ask you your thoughts on this. Alcaraz, is he going to have other challenges? Because what's been great about the last few years is we've had Nadal and we've had Djokovic and we've had Federer, and there's been a little bit of a kind of shifting in who's sort of the top seed at any given time. But are there other players that are going to challenge Alcaraz? Are we going to have that kind of interesting sort of jockeying for position at the top of the sort of leaderboard as far as tennis is concerned?
Well, Djokovic, it's a good question. Djokovic keeps himself so fit.
Yeah.
He's going to be around for a fair few years. Nadal, maybe one more year. Yeah, you've got some really interesting up and coming players. Players like Casper Ruud, Danish, and some players from the States coming through. Sebastian Korda, for example. But no household names. But it goes to show not many people have heard of Carlos Alcaraz till he goes through it. And what's people love. But you're right, that could be a danger if there's just one person who's a superstar. People like rivalries.
Yeah.
And that's women's tennis as well. You know, my era is Chrissy Evert and Martina Navratilova. I love that rivalry.
Yeah. I'm a Borg McEnroe fan. That was the last time I really enjoyed tennis.
Another amazing rivalry as well. Yeah, exactly. So let's see. But we'll come back to it, and I'll come back to the maths on it. But I guess we better crack on.
We had better crack on.
Because we're not covering the data, but there is US inflation.
Yes, we've got that out on Thursday, haven't we?
Less good. So the headline is expected to tick up a little bit, but then we'll be looking at the core. So the month-to-month number is expected to be low, but base effects come in.
Yeah.
So a very low read last month. So it's expected to tick up from 3 to 3.3. Not to be alarmed, but we'll cover it maybe in more detail next week.
Yeah. Because I think the key thing is before the next Fed meeting, we've got another jobs report and we've got two CPI reports coming out. So I guess we should talk about last week's jobs report first, shouldn't we? What were the key takeaways from that?
So it had a bit in it for everyone. So the headline data, the employment report, was a miss. It's called non-farm payroll. It was a miss for the first time in 15 months.
Yeah.
And so that encourages soft landing.
As it was slightly, there were fewer jobs added than anticipated.
The way they do it in the States is the most reliable data is the number of jobs created as opposed to the rate. They use two different surveys to calculate it. And that's the most reliable, although it does get revised. The revisions were downwards. So there's softness in that part of the report. So soft landing tick, but wages ticked up again. So it was 0.5% down day in the stock market, nothing dramatic. You and I have seen much worse for employment reports and inflation. But I would say the jury's out on that piece of data.
Okay. And then obviously not off the back of that, but linked to that as far as market reaction goes, we had the Fitch downgrade as well, didn't we?
So yeah, that's my first topic. So let's go to the Fitch downgrade. So in itself, not really much news because US Treasuries are always going to be held. S&P did this in 2011, i.e. downgrade the US in 2011, and no major impact. But there was some messaging in there. So the first message was the debt ceiling issues that we have and an accidental default, which is well known about. But I actually would like to focus on the more serious area, which is the big deficits that they're running in the US. And when I come to talk about one of the bulls one of the bears of US stocks, who's kind of said, I've got it wrong. He cites this. So basically the numbers are this. The US budget deficit for this year and several years ahead is basically 6%.
Okay.
Where are we in the UK? UK's in a tough spot. We're at 4.
Okay.
You know, a big part of UK spending, and this is a warning, spoiler alert, there's a rant coming, because hardly anyone talks about this, is interest payments.
Yes.
Why? I think we have mentioned it, far too much of the UK, I am going to come back to the US by the way, but far too much of the UK government debt is inflation linked.
Yes.
5%.
Yeah.
Okay, so what does that mean? Well, as inflation reaches 10% or higher than 10%, and worse than that, these inflation linked bonds are based on retail price index, so add another 1 to 2% on top.
Yeah.
It's costing us taxpayers a fortune.
Mm.
No one looks at this decision. Why did we issue so many inflation-linked
debt? Yeah. Why? Why did we?
Great question. Why? Well, I'd say the reason they all say was pension funds wanted them.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I'm tempted to nearly swear and say, well, you know, so what? It's, you know, we don't run the country for pension funds.
No.
We run the country for taxpayers. So anyway, our debt interests are making our deficit much worse than that.
Right.
We're approaching 10% of income in terms of debt payments. Wow. Hopefully it will come down as inflation comes down finally.
Yes.
Yeah. But the point being, the other thing is they're not fit to purpose.
Okay.
So Sarah. Right.
Yeah.
I like to think of you're going to put me on the spot, aren't you?
Okay.
I'll ask you a question. Spoiler, okay. There's a question coming up. You're like one of our entrepreneur clients who knows an awful lot about their business, but you're not expected to be a specialist in investments. That's why I'm
here. Exactly. That's why you're here.
Yeah, but the last year was a terrible year for inflation everywhere, especially the UK, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
The inflation bonds could be good.
Logic would say, I feel this is a bit of a kind of a leading question here. Yeah. Logic would say that an inflation-linked bond should do well in a high inflation environment, but I have a feeling you're going to tell me they didn't.
They didn't. Would you believe inflation-linked bonds fell 33%?
What?
Yes. Thank you. Hey. So I call them the devil's instrument. And the debt management office of the UK is going to bar me, you know, they issue things. They're devilish for finances, and then investors get sucked in because they're inflation linked.
Because there's some kind of inflation proofing, I guess, like tips in the US, I guess.
So there is. So let's be clear, there is. Mm. But an inflation linked bond is two things.
Right.
It has inflation linking, which is important.
It's
costing the government 10%. On that, and more last year, but they're also typically a very long dated bond.
Right. Okay.
Happened to longer dated bonds last year, got absolutely hammered.
Yeah.
And they're much more, you know, getting mathematical here, correlated with long dated bonds than they are inflation.
Right.
So when we're looking at it, without inflation, the return would have been minus 43.
Okay.
Horrendous. So look, I've never wanted to put them in portfolios. Now, a 1 or 2 year inflation linked bond, fine.
Yeah.
Obviously, the truth will be out over 1 or 2 years. But these long dated inflation linked bonds, they're absolutely often, you know, bought by investors without really understanding. And then it costs us as taxpayers a fortune as well.
Yeah.
So that's my rant over on the UK side. But at least we are getting our deficit down. And
yeah.
US looks in a tough place because not only is its deficit high, we all know about the Inflation Reduction Act.
Yes.
For example, you know, increasing spending, you know, maybe it will work. But you remember the days of Liz Truss and Kwasi?
Yes.
And you remember the one
vividly.
The one fact they used to really hang themselves on, G7 debt to GDP, the second lowest. The lowest, of course, you know, this one you do know. The G7, the country, the most prudent country in the G7.
Is Germany, if I remember correctly.
Germany, yes.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly.
So Germany's an outlier in prudishness. The rest are all over the place. But the UK is at least the second lowest, including, so the UK, because there's not many good things about the UK these days.
No.
The UK is the second lowest in the G7. And Kwasi and Liz Truss was right to point that out, but they just, you know, rush their policy, obviously. Come back to that another day. And the US is higher. So it has higher levels of debt to GDP and big deficits. So I think, you know, dare I say, Fitch was almost pointing to, is this kind of Liz Truss Kwasi kind of policy here? Let's see. So a bit of a worry. So big supply of US treasuries.
Yeah.
Because guess what? When you have these big deficits, a big supply of US treasuries. And so no surprise that US treasuries aren't really performing.
Mm.
They're fine because the good news is if you do the maths, big deficits, what does it mean? Not a lot because there's other factors.
Yeah.
But, it's just holding them back. So I kind of stand by use bonds for income.
Yeah. But I mean, the other thing is, which we saw, I guess, after the Fitch downgrade, is that nobody buys US treasuries because they're AAA rated. They buy them because they're US treasuries, don't they? And in fact, I think I read yesterday that Warren Buffett has confirmed he's going to carry on buying short-term US treasuries, and the downgrade has no impact on his investment decisions.
True, but he's buying T-bills, so it's quite interesting. Okay. You know, so 3 months and 6 months and 1 year T-bills, yeah. And absolutely, everything you said there, Sarah, is absolutely right. What we're saying here, just like say in the UK, just because the UK has a bit of a borrowing problem, is the UK going to go bust? No, of course not. Just issues bonds, and it's the price to pay. But there is already a higher price to pay for this debt.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm saying, what I'm giving Fitch a little bit of credit for, is pointing to the fact that, wow, debt to GDP, about 110 to 115%, and deficits of 6%. That's not exactly AAA. But no worries about default or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, before we move on then, so just to summarise then, we've got obviously Fitch downgraded US sovereign debt last week to, I think, is it AAA now? AA now from AAA, is that correct?
Correct.
Right. And essentially, they articulated concerns about the sort of increasing size of the US budget deficit is now 6%. Let's remind ourselves that the UK is only 4%. So we're not necessarily the worst as far as that's concerned. And, you know, concerns about, you know,
got to jump future. In, we're the worst for inflation linked debt.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yes, yeah, that is true.
UK down for this dependence on UK inflation linked debt.
Yeah, that is true. Okay. All right then. Well, we're moving on to the sort of the US economy, bulls and bears. We struggled for a long time to find any bulls. We have found some, and now you've got somebody who's gone bearish from being bullish, or you've got somebody who's gone bullish from being bearish. Which way around?
So one of the most renowned, so two aspects to this. Firstly, we had Amazon and Apple's results out just to add.
Yes.
Pretty solid. Amazon, very impressive.
Yes.
Able to show both sales growth and earnings growth.
What was behind that? What was sort of driving that?
So all their businesses, actually, even their fabled. So most people admire their cloud business.
Yeah.
Most analysts really admire their cloud business. I should say I'm no Amazon or Apple analyst. So, look, this is relatively cursory analysis. But, you know, from what I've read and you know, for example, Terry Smith at Fundsmith, who's been, I think, in and out of Amazon, has always admired his cloud business, computing cloud business, Amazon's cloud business has been very strong, but some doubts on the service that most of us use, the, you know, getting packages through the post.
Yeah.
But
I don't, but yeah.
Yeah, you don't. Wow.
I must be one of the few.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is working much better as a business. To put simply. Whereas Apple, iPod sales, I'm sure my age.
back in the day, one for teenagers.
Yeah, I was actually, the reason is I was driving my brown car and it uses an iPod still to play the music. And so there you go. iPhone struggling in the United States. Good sales, the rest of the world, but weak currencies. So translated into dollars, less strong.
Okay.
But one aspect that's holding Apple up is return to shareholders via stock buybacks.
Yes. There's a bit of controversy around that.
I'm a fan of stock buybacks, and a lot of people are not.
Yeah. Because I was reading that there's an argument. What are they talking about, making them illegal in America or something? Because there's an argument that companies should be putting more money into research and development and improving wages and benefits of staff before they start basically buying back stock. Isn't that the argument against buybacks?
Couldn't you say the same about dividends?
Well, yeah, I suppose you could do, yeah.
Yeah, so that's the point. I look at it as just a replacement for dividends. And what they do, what I like about it, okay, it does improve earnings per share, but it decreases the share count. So us long-term investors own a tiny bit more of the company each time. Yeah. But let's do that in more depth, because what we really want to cover is the macro. So Mike Wilson, Morgan Stanley chief US stock market analyst, and has been superb credit to him for getting calling the market right. But he's been really bearish this year, like everyone. As we said, we found one bull. He's basically said, okay, I've got it wrong. I've got it wrong. And he actually blames excessive, or one of the things he blames is excessive government spending, keeping the economy going.
Yeah.
So he's acknowledging the rally, but he still says, look, you've got to be careful. You've got to be very selective. But he basically says, I'm wrong. And it's getting harder to find a bear, which is a bit of a worry, you know. But JP Morgan, Marko Kalanovic, is sticking with it. Shall I give you his key bearish points?
Yeah, go on.
Bearish. One, disagree that there's going to be a soft landing.
Okay.
See, 65% chance of recession. Multiples are far too high, so the rating on stocks are far too high.
Yeah.
Like 20 times earnings. And there's no easing of monetary policy coming through. So fairly hard hitting. So still bearish out there, Marko. And I follow him. I think he's very good. But so is Mike Wilson. So there you go. Morgan Stanley giving up on it and reflecting markets, and JP Morgan sticking with it in terms of being bearish.
Are we in danger then of there being a little bit too much exuberance then if markets start to see that we're going to get perhaps hopefully that soft landing? Do you think things are going to get, people are going to get a little bit carried away with themselves?
Could be. As you know, Sarah, I don't like to be short term. We've got a tactical team here at Coutts that have that very difficult job. But yeah, you could say we're overdue a 10% correction. We get 10% corrections all the time.
Yeah.
We could easily get one. Do I have any confidence in forecasting it? No. You know, I'm very much stocks for the long run type of investor. Let's see if JP Morgan changes his mind. That could be a worry, but there are some tentative signs of exuberance. I think you're right there.
Okay, so essentially then we've got sort of, and we, of course, we did record a special episode with Howard Sparks on US earnings, so have a listen to that. It's up on the coots.com, and wherever you go and get your podcast from, you can listen to that. But just bringing it up to date, we had Amazon and Apple earnings come out. Amazon really, really strong, very, very strong. Apple, a little bit disappointing, but their earnings per share stayed fairly sort of steady because of a sort of share buybacks. You know, we struggled in the past to look for a bull, but there seemed to be a slightly more bullish tendency now. Mike Wilson from Morgan Stanley has come out a little bit less bearish. And remind me of the other gentleman's name, Marko.
Marko Kalanovic. He's staying.
He's still bearish.
There are other bears out there. They're just harder to find than they used to be. When it's completely the other way around, just 6 months ago, right?
So in 6 months' time, I'm going to be saying, Alan, find me a bear. It's going to be the same struggle. All right. Right. Our last one then, changing the subject ever so slightly, we constantly have this discussion about challenges to equities. And, you know, this came to our mind because obviously the very sad death of Jane Birkin, I think whilst you were on holiday, actually, wasn't it? Wonderful, amazing, incredible woman, very talented, very stylish. But that obviously made us think about Hermes bags, and we've both got a little bit of an obsession with Hermes bags, it turns out. So I guess I don't know. How do you want to start this one?
Well, I think you know how it all started, don't you?
Well, I do actually for my sins. Jane Birkin, obviously, you know, British style icon, partner of Serge Gainsbourg, French singer, sort of, I don't know, artist, whatever. And she was famously always seen with a basket, I believe she bought in Portugal. Apparently Serge Gainsbourg absolutely hated it, but anyway, that's what she carried everywhere. She was sitting on a plane next door to Jean-Louis Dumas, who was executive chairman of Hermès at the time in, I think, 84. And she was complaining that she couldn't find a bag suitable for a young mother. And, you know, everything was falling out of her bag. And he said, well, what you need, Jane, is an Hermès bag. And she said, well, the day you make an Hermès bag with pockets in it, maybe I'll get one. And he said, well, we'll make one for you with pockets in, if you like. And so apparently she sketched the sort of the tentative design for a Birkin bag on a sick bag sitting next door to Jean-Louis Dumas on the plane. And the Birkin bag was born. And they sort of asked her permission to put her name on it. And so apparently it was based on a bit of a combination of the Kelly bag, obviously named after Grace Kelly, and a suitcase that Serge had owned. So that's how the Birkin bag was owned. And I can tell you, in her lifetime, she'd owned five Birkins, but she only ever owned one at a time. And when she used them to death, they were covered in stickers and charms and goodness what else. And then when she had used them to death, probably the world's smartest baby bag, I think, she would sell them for charity and then go and get herself a new one, pop into Hermes. Now, she's lucky. She could go into Hermes and get a Birkin. I looked online to see how much a Birkin costs now, because I'm going to ask you in a minute, what's the better investment, a Birkin bag or shares in Hermes? And you can't buy them. I mean, everybody, anybody that knows anything about Birkin knows you can't actually, there is this sort of mythical kind of unavailability of Birkin bags. Even you can't even go on a waiting list. The waiting list doesn't exist. And if you go into an Hermes store, you can't, well, unless you, if you're a normal person, you can't go in. Even if you've got the money in your hand, you can't go and buy one. So I couldn't even tell you what it would cost to buy one, you know. I can tell you what it would cost to buy one pre-loved, as they say. And I guess depending on condition. Yeah, it depends a little bit. If it's one of the really desirable colours, like a sort of classic tan, you're talking about good condition, probably about 20,000 from a reputable reseller. You know, from I didn't look at Sotheby's, but they're, you know, Sotheby's varies. Other auction websites are available. You can buy them from. So anything from probably 10,000 if it's not great condition. And then you can go up to, you can be pushing $500,000 if it's a really rare one with a sort of really rare skin and, you know, gold hardware and all that kind of thing. So you know, there's a fairly wide price. But if I bought, I think the last I looked at a secondhand Birkin when I was in the States in around 2005, 2006, beautiful blue one. And that was $4,000. So my question is, if I'd spent $4,000 in 2006 on a Birkin, let's say I could sell it now for £20,000, quick bit of calculation there, would I have done better if I'd put $4,000 into Hermes stock?
You'd have definitely done better in Hermes stock. So look, let's step back. That's great information. And look, so there's no doubt they've been great investments. There's challenges, just like a lot of these investments. Bid off the spreads. Well, you just made the challenge, but a bit like Wimbledon debentures, can you even get them at the so-called offering price? And the bid off the spreads, what you sell them for, what you buy them for, etc. But look, Knight Frank did a study on Hermes bags in general, not Birkins. Yeah. And a very specific time period, but March 10 to March 2010, over that 10-year period. So kind of the pandemic lows for stocks. And Hermes bags have more than doubled. So it's about a 7% compound rate. So a decent return. So competing with stocks.
Yeah. Definitely. And presumably that's an average over all their bag designs, because there'll be some that will go up a little bit, and then you've got your Birkins that will really hold their value.
Yeah, I have reached out to Knight Frank to try and get in touch with the person who's written the report to get a bit more information. So don't know exactly how they did it, but it's in line with your experience, interestingly. Yours is a bit earlier in 06. So it is in line with expectations. But I'm pleased to say, as a long-term advocate of stocks for savings, is that over the same period, global stocks, this is from a euro base, made 180% over double it, so a higher return. A part of that would have been, there would have been some currency in there. So maybe not fair, but I think these are big numbers. I would say, if you look at stocks versus Hermes Birkin bags, if you're lucky enough to get them either very cheaply like you in that time in New Yorker where you didn't actually buy.
I didn't. No, because I didn't have $4,000.
Or those people lucky enough to go to the Hermes store and get it at cost price, probably the same, but undoubtedly, what is better? Hermes stock. Oh, my God, what a company.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting because, we talked about valuation. So there's two reasons for a stock going up. Very simple. You forget the short run. One, the so-called truth. I earnings.
Yeah.
Simply earnings come through, and therefore you just benefit from the stronger business environment. And the second reason stocks go up is it gets revalued. Well, both happened to Hermes over that period. Mm. So I can tell you it went up 620%.
Goodness me.
And I'm going to say two really sad things right now. One, I don't own a Hermes Birkin bag. Two, I don't own Hermes stock, so shame on me. I probably do on an underlying basis because I own a lot of funds. Of course I do. But it basically went from 25 times earnings, so already expensive, to 50 times earnings, big picture.
Yeah.
So a double in its valuation.
Yeah. Okay. And what period does that cover? Did you say 2010 to?
Yeah, the same period as the Knight Frank period.
Okay.
2010 to 2020.
Because it was around about 2010, I think, that LVMH very nearly or did their best to take over Hermès and get a controlling share.
The family, they need to persuade the family.
Yeah,
the family
exactly.
The whole controlling stake.
Yeah.
They can't. So there is an increase in valuation, but you can see the vast majority of that exceptional performance is great corporate performance.
Yeah.
Which is, to be fair, LVMH is similar, luxury goods. Is a strong area, and to answer the question that what's been better, Hermès bags or Hermès stock, but we will have to come back to this. I loved your story about Birkin. I've got a story, remind me, about how Rolex, with also a great book recommendation, how Rolex came to be at Wimbledon.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
It's
actually, that's
another family-owned business, so we'll save that for another time. But also has some great advice for careers in there, but we'll save that for another time. But I think we've done it to death. So we will keep looking for luxury and other goods which compete with equities.
Yeah, definitely. So I think the conclusion is, if you choose to buy Hermès stock or a Birkin bag, it is entirely up to you. It's certainly, we're not making investment recommendations or style recommendations, but certainly if you're looking purely from an investment perspective, probably the Hermès stock is a better buy, but it has been in the past, exactly.
Thank you.
The past performance, yeah, exactly. But you might have more fun with the Birkin bag. But anyway, thank you very much, Alan, for joining me today. Don't forget, I should say a reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are not intended to constitute investment advice or fashion advice for that point of view, are accurate at the time of recording and are subject to change. Thank you very much, Alan, for joining me today. Don't forget to check out the podcast page on Coutts.com and subscribe to the podcast via Apple, Spotify, or wherever you access your podcasts. You can listen to previous episodes, including, as I mentioned earlier, a recent bonus episode in which I spoke with Howard Sparks, our US equities specialist, about US earnings season. We'll be back next week with more Need to Know. Until then, bye for now.